Hello, everybody. Welcome again to the Doomer Optimism Podcast. I have my trusty sidekick here, Ashley Colby, and a special guest, Michelle Bowens. Just for a little bit of context for myself, I've been following Michelle's work for a few years. It's shaped a lot of my thinking, especially around these notions of cosmolocalism, peer-to-peer, the commons. And I've even taught some of his text in my classes, in my college classes. So I'm a big fan, and I'm excited to finally get you on, Michelle.
It's Michelle, but Michael is fine because
okay, either way.
I lived a year in the U.S. and I was always confused with female at back in the days.
Right.
So okay. I know Michael is more easy in the U.S. to avoid confusion. But yeah, you're right. My name is Michelle.
Yeah. Okay.
In French we add an E when it's female. Without E, it's the male version.
Okay. Well, I'll try and remember. I'll try and remember how you pronounce it. So why don't we start? Give a little bit of your background, whatever you think is relevant, and we'll go from there.
All right. So, I'll just do the digital part of my life. So in the 90s, I was pretty early with the internet, at least in Belgium. I was really one of the first ones, and especially one of the first ones who saw that, like, this would change the world and be applied to business and government. And then I created two startups in the 90s. One that was called Ecom. It was sold to Alcatel, which used to be like a big telco at that time. And then I did another one called Kyberco, which was sold to another holding company, but that one didn't do so well because, it was 2000. So the internet bubble bursting and losing like 90% of your clientele in, just a few weeks. And I ended up working for a digital strategy post in the biggest telco of Belgium. But I was getting like unhappy about what I was doing. And, I saw the world was, I didn't think the world was going, moving forward in any positive way that I could see. Like, everything you looked at was going a bit downhill. It was also the time of the Zapatistas, of the Seattle movement. And so, in the mid-90s, I started thinking, am I part of the problem or am I part of the solution? And I thought, in these big companies, I'm not part of the solution. This is getting toxic and short-termism and, fiddling with the accounting, all kinds of stuff that you see happening. But I didn't know what to do, so I took a two-year sabbatical. And the aim of my sabbatical, which I financed by myself, was to really to think through how transitions occur, right? Because I grew up as a, radical left-winger when I was in my 20s. And obviously, the strategy of the big revolution and then we will change everything didn't exactly turn out the way we expected it.
Around what year was this sabbatical?
So this was 2002, 2003.
Okay.
And I had just, been to Thailand on a holiday, and as happens many times here, people get stuck. Because Thailand has a surplus of women. This is just objective fact. There's a lot of trans people here. So, it's 20% of the boys are not available. And so there's a 3-century-long tradition of, intermarriage here. So I fell into the trap and I've been happy ever since. But that was a good convergence between my desire to do the sabbatical and knowing that if I would come here, my money would go 4 times more, right? So at that time, it was the level of pricing was 25% of Europe. maybe now it's like 35. But so that means if you have $1,000 in, you know, in Belgium, it feels like 4,000 here, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why Chiang Mai and Thailand in general, but Chiang Mai especially, has been a very attractive place because it's a real city. You know, it's not city like, you know, you can find in Thailand, some places like Pattaya or, you know, in Phuket. This is like a normal city, very cosmopolitan, you know, where the grocery shops are more richly stocked than in Spain or in France, because you have Koreans here and Japanese, and like the whole world is here. And this place went from 300,000 to 1 million. And now it's the Chinese wave. We have 100,000 Chinese that moved here since 2013. So this is a special place that, you know, and if you, I don't know if it's interesting, but if you put a circle of 1,000 kilos or miles, I forgot. You have like 2/3 of the world population around Chiang Mai, you know. So this is not like, I feel this is a special place. And so I moved here and I studied transition. But mostly at that time, I was looking at, you know, Roman Empire, feudalism, like the Western stuff. Because, you know, 2 years of reading is really, you think it's a long time, but like it's gone like before you know it. But I came out with a very clear idea that, you know, seed forms are the key.
Seed forms? Right? So,
seed forms. Seed forms are the key. So basically the classic idea of the left, you know, the revolutionary left was, you know, you create a revolution and you change everything. But, you know, so you have the French and the Russian Revolution that stuck in our minds. But those are very exceptional, right? There's like at least 10 different ways it went in Germany and in Sweden. And so there's many ways in which the societies can change, but it's also a long process. And so you could argue that if there weren't capitalists, you know, we wouldn't have capitalism, right? So so markets are pretty old, 2,000-3,000 years old, but the type of capitalism that emerged specifically in Europe is because we had free cities, weak empire. And so, you know, the market forces could develop themselves unimpeded and create a world to their image, right? And so the way that happens is through seed form. So you have a system, let's say feudalism or the Roman Empire, and when it ended in its descending phase, you know, it just doesn't work anymore, right? So either you have people with anticipatory consciousness, the pioneers, the idealists, the utopians that you know, think through and say, we need to do something different. And then you have all the people who are just pushed out of the system. You know, the slaves flee or are freed by the Germanic tribes that come in, or, you know, the serfs flee their land to go to work in the cities, or they're chased away to the cities. So you have like a crisis, an exodus, and then both the managerial and the productive classes have to kind of find something new. And the way that happens is through seed forms, through pioneers that invent new ways of doing things that solve issues that the old logic cannot solve, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, purgatory, I know it's a strange example, but, you know, if you were a Christian under feudal Christianity, you couldn't lend money, you would go straight to hell, right? So once they say purgatory, you can lend money, and then you can buy an indulgence and you free yourself from your sin, right? That's a perfect ideological hack.
That's would allow anticipatory thinking right there, thinking ahead.
Yeah. And then, you know, somebody else invents the printing press, right? And that allows ideas to move so much faster that the institution of the church can no longer control ideas. And then you have double entry book accounting, right? So these are seed forms that within capitalism, within feudalism, create the seeds of a next system. And then, you know, they form a subsystem. Let's say that the printing press is combined with a company system. So the actually company is doing the printing, right? And they use double entry book accounting. And so suddenly these patterns start coalescing, and the social forces around them start strengthening. And then you might have, you know, a qualitative step at some point where, you know, the emergent alternative actually becomes a dominant new form, right? And so actually, if I can say something maybe provocative about crypto here, and I know some people think this is far-fetched, but just follow my reasoning. So okay. 5,000 years ago, right, we shift from kinship and tribal organization with gifting and commoning as the dominant ways of value exchange to civilization with classes and castes and independent military and states and markets, right? It's a very big shift that occurred about 5,000 years ago. And this is because of writing. So you have a new class of people who invent the alphabet, which is much more convenient than the ideographic and cuneiform alphabets. So they invent the alphabet. And so the people who can read become an elite, right? And they will be at the service of the kings and the churches and the temples. And so there is like this new managerial elite that is created and that manages society. So now we invent code, right? And we invent a group of people who know how to code, and not everybody knows how to code. They have computers as their means of production, which is very easy to acquire, but they don't control the networks that make them work together, right? So what do they do? And I think this is a parallel. So they try to create a world according to their image so that they can do what they want to do. And so naturally, because they're kind of craft workers, you know, they're not proletariat in the sense of working 10,000 people in a big factory. No, they're all like independent, you know, freelancers mostly. And so they're creating this new world of infrastructure that is anti-big government, anti-big finance. And I'm not saying it's working all the time and it's very problematic and we can discuss the details, but I think this is very important because the big change for me is from a geographically based civilization, right? Where are you familiar probably with Jordan Hall and his idea of civium, right? So he's basically saying that cities are super linear in their effects. So sublinear means you have, you know, you double your body, but your brain doesn't double. It's only 85%. So that's a sublinear relation. You lose efficiency with scaling. But according to a criteria of innovation and all of that stuff, that's actually super linear in a city because of, you know, all that collective intelligence and the level and the depth of the connections creates a force for change that is just not available in the countryside, you know, where, and so here's the argument that by creating the digital, right, we've created a new superlinearity, which is not geographic, right? And so that means for me that the market and the state forms, which were adapted to this geographical form of civilization, are actually now also in crisis. And so I'm an advocate for what I call mutual signaling as the new form of societal coordination. So if you look at open source, urban commons, crypto communities, what they're doing is they're creating open ecosystems where everybody can see what everybody else is doing, right? And so that means that next to market pricing and next to, let's say, hierarchical command, you have millions of people now working through horizontal forms of coordination, which never scaled before, but are now scaling so that even if you're like a capitalist company, you'll be more competitive if you, you know, move towards open source practices, right? And so all of this is happening at the same time, but I think this is coalescing into, you know, and that's why I call it the fourth generation civilization. So the So just to be brief about this, but so Spengler is like the first macro historian who you know really looks at the whole world at the whole time and works around the notion of civilization. And he says a civilization is a self-contained organism that goes through birth, youth, maturity, and death. And it's about 1,000 years, and there's nothing you can do about it, and then you die as a civilization, right? And so European civilization, according to Spengler, only started in the year 1,000. So now we're at the end of that story. Toynbee, who came after Spengler and wrote a 12-volume, The Study of History, the Spengler is called Decline of the West. And he says that's not entirely true because there is actually also accumulation of complexity, of technology, of knowledge. And so what you get is generations of civilization. And there's different ways to read it, but you could say, okay, so you have mythical civilization, you know, they follow their gods, and their gods speak to them and their local gods and then tell them what to do, like in Assyria and Babylon, right? Then you have mythical rational civilizations, like Greece or the Christian West, where, you know, they're kind of both at the same level, and people believe, but they can also philosophize at the same time, right? And then we have the Western industrial civilization has become rationalistic and rejects belief and mythology, right? So you could say these are like three generations of civilization. And so the fourth generation would be one that is, you know, where the dominant factor is actually, so this is my thesis, it's not the market and the state, but the commons. And so maybe I can give you a little argumentation around that. So I see civilization as cyclical. You know, everything pulses, everything is polarities, you know, matter, life, human culture. So you get an ascending phase, you know, when everything works well and is being synergized and, you know, as a new model and it's working and it's productively oriented and it allows the country to expand, right? And it always reaches a peak. And then it starts descending. In the ascending phase, the extractive institutions that depend on growth and conquest work well to provide everything, you know, to create legitimacy and loyalty in the core, you know, of its geographical location. When it's descending, this is less and less the case. So more and more people fall outside of the boat. And so I call this the pulsation of the commons. So the commons weaken in the A phase, but they are gaining strength in the B phase, right? And so, but this was always local and regional. And so when one society would collapse, the civilization would just move, basically. So you can see, like in China or in the Mayas, you know, a succession of capitals, even Rome, you know, Rome and then what was it, Ravenna, and then it was, you know, Byzantium. So so it moves around because it has exhausted its core. You know, they, you know, overuse wood and you know, the agriculture is declining, etc. And so the commons, this is a generative institution. It's designed to preserve over the long term. So it's not so good at extraction, but it's very good at providing the basic needs of a local population, right? So for example, if you think, you know, why is Switzerland so green or Austria or Japan? It's because the villagers manage their mountain slopes for the long term, so that the children and the children, their children can, you know, can get the nuts and the fruit and the, you know, and all the stuff that is so, and they manage to keep the control of that over the centuries, even today, right? So if you actually take a satellite, you it's very clear that the commons are regenerative because those are the green areas in the world, and you know the ones that are brown are the ones that are being extracted. So it's actually just the opposite of what, you know, liberal market thinking things, which is, you know, make it private and then the private property will, you know, preserve preserve it, right? But that's not how it works. They exhaust it and then they go somewhere else. Because, you know, we work with money now, right? So if it doesn't make, if you don't make money here, it doesn't matter. You go somewhere else and you make money there. And the commons is linked to real communities in place. But here is the big change. So we're now at the stage where we have an international state system and a transnational financial system. The transfinancial system has become stronger than the interstate system. So change within the nation state has become impossible. Whether you want to do it on the left or on the right doesn't matter. You know, you within 3 days, they close the banks. You can't get your money from the ATM. So we can't do the politics we're used to. That's why people go crazy, because whether you vote left or right doesn't make any difference. You know, they're so constrained. So I think what that means is that we have to create transnational counterpower, you know, productive civic systems, right? And that's what I call cosmolocalism. So making sure you have access to all the provisioning systems that you need, so food, energy, transport, housing. But at the same time, you need to have the superlinearity of digital proximity. So everything that's heavy is local, and everything that's light is global and shared. So it's about combining relocalized, distributed manufacturing and production, but with commons institutions that have all the protocols of cooperation at scale. And so you go from economies of scale to economies of scope, doing more with the same thing. And any innovation in the network becomes instantly available everywhere. And so I think this is happening. But, you know, of course, it's happening in a messy way, and there's corruption and there's speculation, and, you know, capitalism tries to get its hand on it and change its nature. So all this is going on. But I think underneath it, there is a transitioning that is actually occurring already, right? And it's not nearly enough, but it's there. Many people know it. Many people are trying it. So there is energy there to do this.
Okay, so some counterpoints. Okay, so first of all, I completely agree on your assessment of the civilizational structure. This is like my wheelhouse. I love this, thinking about like the rise and fall of civilizations, where we are in that process, and what we can possibly do to, what is the word you used? It was so good. Anticipatory consciousness. I love that.
Right.
So I love thinking about that. And that's basically like right in the wheelhouse of where this podcast is thinking, you know, in an anticipatory way about like where we are, you know, in historical cycles and what we could possibly do to be prepared for what's coming. I think the nitty gritty details of what that means is what we dig into all the time, because we're trying to figure out, you know, are our assumptions correct? Is the way forward correct that we're, you know, perceiving? So there's two things that I'm interested in digging into a little bit. One is, so the movement from that you were talking about 5,000 years ago, from like this kinship gifting civilization to, you know, written civilization with markets and states and all of this stuff, to me is a move toward more alienation. In so far as those who have the power to write then have more control over other people, then the state and markets sort of take control away from the more local and kinship and community and relational and like human scaled understandings of ledgers of, you know, debts and, you know, gift economies, as opposed to, you know, like a more rational written level. And so my first concern is that taking it from that to then the digital is necessarily a step in the direction of more alienation, less human scaled, embodied, you know, in nature, in ecosystems, understandings of ledgers, and it's more alienated and more difficult to parse unless you're well-versed in it, which then can make a class of people who are well-versed and can kind of take advantage of people who don't know what's going on in the crypto world, which is happening. You know, there is a lot of like utopian thinking of, oh, the crypto will just make sure it's secure and then it'll work great. And then, oh, okay, I guess it just so happens that governments can still control this somehow, even though we've said that they shouldn't be able to, but they can. So there's some concerns I have, like just about the utopian thinking, although I really like the anticipatory part of what you're talking about and you know, concerns about that. And then the other part that I'm interested in parsing over the course of this conversation is you said the heavy parts and the light parts. The heavy parts should be local, right, and the light parts should be global. I completely agree with that. But let's talk about which is which, because I've also come across a lot of crypto people or people who are sort of into like smart cities or you know, let's get everything digitized, who are not, who do not have a very moral or thoughtful approach to which is heavy or which is light. And they kind of just want to digitize everything, which then just turns the whole world into a panopticon. And I'm like, we cannot just be like, you know, make everything digital and therefore all our problems go away. Like, there is actually a pigheadedness that's required to not digitize some things.
Right.
Okay. So we can dig into those topics. But wait, okay, hold on. Before you go back again, yeah, Michelle, I want to hear Jason's take too before we get back into your response, because maybe it would be fun right now, Jason, to talk about your back and forth with Balaji. I don't know if you've ever talked about that on the podcast.
I don't think we've talked about that on the podcast. Okay, well, I'll mention that real quick. So Balaji, of course, has this idea of the network state, and I haven't read the book, but I did read a passage, and from there it seemed to me that he was trying to create this new kind of global elite class of people, digital nomads, you could say, who kind of go around to their various territories that are within the network state, don't have very much skin in the game in any one particular territory, aren't very well integrated into the local cultures. And so I critiqued that in a thread, and I actually said the alternative is something more cosmo-local, where each node, you could say, is well integrated in the culture, and you do have people who are there long term and skin in the game. And he responded, and we had a back and forth, and he eventually suggested that there was a compromise of what he referring back to the Hanseatic League, and then thinking like a digital Hanseatic League would be Cosmo local application of his network state idea. But that was my concern with the kind of Balaji line of thinking, and that line of thinking is that I am concerned with this idea, these ideas of digital nomad, that you have a bunch of nomads, but you don't have any localists. You don't have actually any people who have been there for generations.
I
you know what I mean?
I actually
understand the evolution of that culture and society. And so that there was a little bit of back and forth there.
I want to say that I fully sympathize with both of your critiques. Let me first say a little bit about alienation. I actually experienced this myself. So just at a personal level, I'm an only child from one orphan mother and a semi-orphan father. I come from the very atomized Western society. And here I live with my Thai wife and her mother has 11 brothers and sisters who have 3 and 4 children who have 1 or 2 children each, right? And my neighbors is my wife's family, like on 3 sides. And I cannot, you know, describe how happy I am here. Like, I'm literally in a sea of love, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's, I don't know why it still exists here to a certain degree. You know, it's not perfect, but it's better preserved than in many, many, many other parts of the world. And one of the reasons is that Thailand was never colonized. And so, you know, capitalism is actually very recent here. It's from the Americans in the 1960s with the Vietnam War. You know, I mean, they had trade and markets, but they didn't have production. You know, they didn't have consumer society until very, very recently. So, you know, it's going to evolve negatively here as well, but slower and, you know, with a huge delay. And right now, you know, there's still a lot of this kinship thing going on, right? And so, yeah, that's what happened, right? We lived in kinship, and maybe we died earlier and all of that, but like you were living with your uncles and your aunts and, you know, clans and this and that. And so that's the life that we lost. But it's inevitable. And so I'm a big advocate of multi-level selection theory. I don't know if you're a bit familiar with that. You know, it's basically like, you know, so animals, you know, have this kind of, you know, healthy animals survive, weak animals die, and then you get your genes, you know, to the next generations. But in humans, it's not exactly the way it works. It's a weak member of a strong group has more chance to survive than the strong member of a weak group, because we are organized and we fight amongst groups. And so, unfortunately, you know, that alienation was inevitable. As long as you have one group that decides to arm itself, you know, if you don't respond to that, you're the slave, right? So that's a drama of civilization that occurred, you know, 5,000 years ago. And I was reading a book about the history of Greece. And, you know, there is a word for it. I forgot the word now. But literally, you know, there was a process whereby one rich decided to build a city to protect itself, right? And then all the other communities in Greece had to do the same. And so that's how you got the city-state system in Greece, because you needed protection. There was raiding, and so that's one thing, right? It's you have to respond to it. And then the next thing about technology, I think, is a bit more, I think we are technological beings. So that what makes humans human is actually, you know, that we have language, that we have tools, that we build structures, that we can adapt. But I also agree that this is a factor of alienation. And okay, maybe you think this is utopian, but so this is an example. So, you know, the average age of a Thai farm is now like 58, right? And one of the reasons is when the children go to public school, they don't want to farm. It's done. You're finished. They just don't want that kind of life, right? And so I imagine an education system where you farm. The kids farm 2 hours a day, and then they craft 2 hours a day, right? So what you're doing is you're building these layers of connection and embodiedness, you know, and that's what we don't do in Western civilization, right? That's what the dualism, the Cartesian dualism, has completely destroyed. But it wasn't, you know, always the case. And you know, I'm actually a fan of the Middle Ages in a way, because, but follow my reasoning. So this was a very local civilization, right? People lived in parishes with their they had family, they had 2 days a week. They didn't have to work. Sunday, the day of the Lord, Blue Monday, the day of the family. They had, I don't know how many saints. So like historians, you know, they think that they had between 100 and 150 days they didn't work. I mean, you know, they were active in preparing festivals and all that kind of stuff. Right. And then you had like the church, which created a unity over a vast territory. So you had both localism, but you still had interconnection and joint culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had in the Middle Ages three cities that were run by the guilds. Right. And so I just want to tell you that story because that's what the Commons is about. So in the 5th century, Europe is completely destroyed, actually in the 8th century, but it starts in the 5th century. And, you know, in, by the 8th century, you have the Saracens, the Muslims come, you know, they're up like 80 kilometers from Paris. The Vikings come from the north. The Avars comes from the east. And it's a total mess, right? And so how do the European people react to it? So the first thing is the Benedictines. So in the 5th century, there's no food in Italy. And so the Rules of Saint Benedict, it's a craft agrarian congregation, right? You live together, you work the land, you make stuff, and you learn all at the same time. So it's a very integrated life. It's no sex, that's something else, but you know, but it was a very integrated and balanced life, right? And all the surplus goes into the infrastructure. You know, there's nobody with a yacht that's 2 billion, and you know, and no, it everything goes. So in 50 years, the Benedictines has restored Italian agriculture, and the Cistercians did the same in the 11th century. 70% of the land was reclaimed by the Cistercians, and you know, each time they had like, I forgot the number, like 48 or 64 people, they had to split like a bee swarm, and then the you know, the group had to find new land and they would start over, right? And so they create a surplus from the land, and so that creates the cities, and in the cities you have the guilds, and these guilds are also a commons organization. You know, they collectively own the means of production. You know, they have these three levels, and they restore city life in Europe. So for me, this is an interesting example. You know, we always think in terms of the Dark Ages, but the Dark Ages, that was like 5th to 10th century. That was the Dark Age because everything was disorganized, constant raiding. But, you know, once, you know, European civilization is actually restored and recreated in around 975, right? And the commons are very effective in recreating a cosmo-local civilization. That's my point of view. So, you know, I'm kind of a neo-medievalist in the sense that I think that what is happening now is kind of similar. We are both relocalizing, but we're creating infrastructures of cultural exchange as a layer. And of course, and that might be utopian. So my hope is, of course, that this combination of things is strong and competitive enough to eventually overcome the crisis of the system that we now have, right? But if you look at transitions in the past, you know, transitions do happen. So crises happen. So you have, you know, ascending phase, descending phase. Then you have crisis and transition, right? And then after a period of chaos, things surge again. So you have a new cycle, ascending, descending, crisis. And then so this is what I've been studying for the last year and a half, is because, you know, I was very confused about all these cycles. And so I have a pretty good idea now of all these cycles actually intersect with each other. And so my theory is that, I hope that is the right word in English, that we have a concatenation of cycles. So we have a 50-year Kondratiev cycle, the 100-year seculum, which is also the war cycle and the hegemony cycle. We have a 400-500 year cycle and a 1,000 year cycle and a 5,000 year cycle. And they're all ending right now. And so each cycle requires different things to be resolved. And that's why we can talk about a meta crisis, right? Because it's not just like an addition of things. So we need an integrative mindset to understand that complexity of, oh, okay, so the cognitive cycle is mostly political economy. So this we can solve by, you know, some economic adaptation. But the seculum, you know, the fourth turning, I'm sure you're familiar with that, you know, Strauss and Ho, the fourth turning. So we're now in the chaos phase of the 100-year cycle. That's a public and civic reorientation. So we need new civic and public institutions to recreate an integrative narrative that we have lost, right? And so every cycle has its own logic. And so we need to know not just where we are, that's very important, And, you know, I can tell you, I don't like cheese and wine. And I'm in Chiang Mai. I don't know why. But just the place, right? And the climate tells me this is not good here. As soon as I've, you know, I'm in Europe, cheese, cheese. I want to eat cheese. it's place, right? Place is really important. And capitalism destroys place. Right now we have, I forgot what it's called, but, you know, like a universal equivalent for ecological destruction, right? So you can say, oh, I'm going to destroy this forest here, but don't worry, I'm buying these credits so that we can create a forest somewhere else. But that's like terrible. That's terrible. Because, you know, the people who live in locally, they're fucked.
Yeah.
Right? So, sorry, I shouldn't use that
that's
language.
Fine.
But, okay. Fine.
Many things have been said on this podcast.
Yeah.
So when is also important, right? You have where we are and when we are, because, you know, there's things you can do in an ascending cycle that you can do in a descending cycle. You know, I give the example, like Disney makes crap, and you can argue why they're making crap, but even if they wanted to make a good movie, they can't. It's just because of the, you know, the general decline of our culture. You know, people can't write anymore. I don't know why that is, but that's like typical for an end cycle, right? In the decline phase, like the culture is just copying itself, right? So now they make music and they make these hooks, and then they put the hooks together, they test the hooks, but like there's no composition anymore. You know, we don't compose music. And how they make series is like by committee, and they sit together and say, oh, should we do this? Should we do that? And so that, like, there's no more harmony, right? The narrative is gone. And so this is very typical, like culturally, of an end stage. So I think, so freedom starts where you, once you know what determines you. If you don't know what determines you, you're not really free. And so integrative thinking is the capacity, I think, to see different lines of development and change, and to be able to creatively combine them and be aware of them, right? I don't know. That's maybe overambitious, but that's the way I think about this.
So there's a couple topics I want to dig into a little bit. So one is on the commons. So how most students think about the commons is Eleanor Ostrom managing natural resources. We know that commons have been common institutions throughout, you know, a lot of history that we know about, a set of rules that communities practice to manage common resources. So that's common resources themselves are kind of a particular kind of good, you can say. They tend to be non-exclusive. You have a set of rules in a community, at least,
right.
You know, they're exclusive to the outside of the community, but not within the community.
Right.
But they're right. Also usually rivalrous goods. This is, you know, kind of in the economic sense, yeah. Of like, if you use too much, they'll be depleted. You can have tragedy, right. Commons if you don't have good institutions. And when we talk about kind of the flip side of that kind of good, you have non-rivalrous, let's say, you can't kind of run out, but they can be excluded. These are normally called artificially scarce goods in like an economics textbook.
Right.
And it seems like what cosmolocalism is trying to do, or trying to create this kind of, you know, have this shared community of what is light, as you say, these fall in the category of artificially scarce goods, meaning that it's like software or knowledge. And if in Microsoft's hands, they'll exclude people from using it unless you buy their product, even though the marginal cost is zero. But with the open source movement, the idea is, no, these actually don't need to be artificially scarce, right? They're actually not rivalrous goods, not like, again, you know, there's only a certain amount of grassland you can put your cows, but, you know, this software, once it's created, it can be duplicated infinite number of times. But in our capitalist system, they are treated as exclusive and they don't need to be. And so it seems like you're in this form of the commons that you often talk about, you're
an actually, inversion. It's an inversion, right?
To beyond its original application, which is really interesting. You're saying that.
Yeah. So actually, I think capital. Yeah. Sorry.
You can actually combine the traditional notion of the commons of natural resource management, and we can say more local communities managing their resources, and we can combine that with making this new kind of knowledge technology not exclusive, and then you get this kind of cosmological system. And then last thing, this differentiation between superlinear and sublinear. And so the idea, I read recently Jordan Hall's article about this, and it was very similar to your ideas, I thought. But
yeah, I mean, that language actually got from him.
Okay.
The idea
is that why do we aggregate to the cities? Because you have this agglomeration effects, you have these superlinear effects, returns to innovation and all of these things. But with the internet and with the possibility of distributed knowledge sharing, that force bringing people to cities is weakening. And so so people might, like, I can work from home, we can talk over the internet. Work from home is obviously one example of this, but suddenly we can share knowledge, we can have this superlinear relationships of innovation, putting our minds together without being in the metropole, so to speak, right? We can be, you know, ideally, theoretically, we can be in our local communities doing our local stuff, our natural resource and cultural commons management, and we can be having these superlinear effects. And one thing you argue is that if we localize without being connected, it'll be a sublinear effect because we'll be cutting ourselves off from a lot of knowledge and technology, and we'll stagnate and probably won't work well. And so you need to have this localization while maintaining this kind of superlinear effect that used to only be possible in the cities, but now can be more distributed.
Yeah, because I think power is important, right? You're not just like, oh, it's nice to do this, it's nice. No, you're living in a complex world where, you know, there's all kinds of conflicts. And so you have to be strong as your community or whatever, however you define it. But then you have to think like, okay, this is the political economy that we're living in. Mm-hmm. And so we better know how to do that and get, you know, what I call it, jurisdictional alliances, right? The capacity to create coalition between groups so that I just want to say, so I think what capitalism does, right, it turns things on its head. So it pretends that the material world is abundant, and it's not. And then it pretends that abundant things should be scarce, and they're not. And so while the market is justified as a market as a scarcity allocation system, you know, pricing works really well for that, it has become a scarcity engineering system, right? Creating terminator seeds and the localization part is important because we spend now three times as much moving things around than actually making them, right? So in terms of sustainability and balance of the world, and, you know, and getting into a steady state economy, we need to do this. This is, like, for me, vital. It's, you know, it's just inevitable that we can't just continue doing what we're doing now. So, you know, I call it the subsidiarity of material production, right? Not everything needs to be localized, but, you know, we need to rethink this. All right. So then at the level of the knowledge, I take a bit of a controversial point of view here, because I think between copy left and copy right, they could be in copy fair. And so here's the problem. So the more communistic the license, the more capitalistic the practice. So open source licensing has led to a software economy which is completely dominated by large capitalist companies. Because if everybody can use it, so can they. And then they have a lot more capital to do stuff with it than you have, right? So what copy fair would be, you know, this is called like strong reciprocity. In French, it sounds really good. Licence à réciprocité renforcée. So license it with reinforced reciprocity is you say, okay, you the knowledge can be shared, but commercialization is dependent on reciprocity. And I think this could create a cooperative alliances, you know, and domains. And so what I call magisteria of the commons, this is something I want to maybe introduce also to your audience, is so transnational finance international state system, right? What we don't have are commons institutions that can operate at the same level. So I see a fractal organization where, you know, if you can succeed in having a jurisdictional alliance at the local level, so you have the city, the commercial sector, the research sector, and the nonprofits allied together to support the commonification process, mutualized provisioning system at the local level to preserve them, right? In a world of increasing scarcity and resource scarcity. So if you have that, that's called the quintuple helix model in Italy. So that already exists. You know, they're like Italian cities are doing this, you know, because they're, you know, I was in Padua and Pavia, and maybe I confuse it too now, but, you know, they were losing like one shop every day. One shop closes every day, you know, in the inner city, right? So they're using the commons as a territorial strategy to protect their local economy. So quintuple alliance, 4+1. And I imagine at the transnational level, would have the same. So let's say you want to do car sharing, real car sharing, not Uber. So mutualizing transportation. And you know, I did this project in Ghent in Belgium, where they had two projects and one had thousands of members, and every shared car replaced 9 to 13 cars. And it was like 80% cheaper for the members, and they had a full guarantee to have a car whenever they needed. And you know, and they calculate that and said, okay, this is not Uber, right? This is like a neighborhood-based system. And then they have different levels to compensate for weaknesses in one neighborhood or another. So these systems, you know, why would you rewrite the software for that, you know, in every city, right? That doesn't make any sense. But that's actually what happens. So I went to Tuscany, and they had like 20 pieces of software to order organic food only in the solidarity economy. Like, what a waste of energy and resources. So that's why you need, you know, knowledge commons, right? You need protocol co-ops. So cooperatives where all the protocols of cooperation are designed, protected, learned, certified, shared. And so I imagine then at the transnational level, you would have a similar quintuple structure of, you know, ethical investments and support NGOs that would, you know, support the knowledge cult, right? And so, and these institutions would be the protector of the commons, right? And that's because we have a commons gap, right? We have a commons gap, not just at the local level, but also at the more global level. Okay, so that's my thinking. And I want to address actually what you said about like the selfishness of the crypto crowd. And I completely agree. So this is like the Exodus principle, right? It's so there are a number of people who think they can escape physicality, right? And so this is what a sociologist like, what is it, David Goodhart and Eric Kaufman and Matthew Goodwin, you know, the somewheres and the nowheres, right? And so this is the class war of our time, right? We had the Christians and the pagans, we had the Reformation and Catholicism, and now it's the culture war. And it's the people who cannot move, bore the brunt of neoliberal globalization, lost the local businesses, lost their work, but can't move because they're not educated and they don't as much and they don't have the digital skills. So they've been getting angry and frustrated. And then you have the nowheres, and well, okay, you know, if Portugal is doing badly, let's go to Greece. If Greece is doing badly, we can go to Bali, right? And this creates this mentality where, you know, oh, with our bitcoins and blockchain and the euros, who cares? We can escape. And no, there's no escape. At some point, they'll be coming for you with a pitchfork, right? And so I think the nowheres should see themselves as everywhere. So from rootlessness to rootfulness. So see yourself as at the service of the local communities. So we'll have relocalization, but we need people like the binding elements of the cosmo-local, right? The agents of the cosmic within the local. This is what we should be. And so, you know, in the labor movement, we had, you know, organic intellectuals, right? This is Gramsci. And so normally intellectuals work for power because you get your money from the mecenas and right? So then because the labor movement self-organized and paid dues, they created the layer of intellectuals that were at the service of the labor movement and has been completely destroyed. That's why we don't no longer have working class culture. And okay, here, this is where, you know, some people hate me for this, but I'll say it anyway. You know, the left has become the voice of the elite cognitive class, mm-hmm. which is allied with financial capital. And yep. they're leaving the other people behind, and they think they're deplorables and fascists and this and that. And so what I see now is we have a fight between two factions of the oligarchy, the, you know, the pure globalists and the people, I think, represented by Trump and Brexit and these kinds of forces that are more rooted in local industry. And they're connecting with the working class against. And so very important is the notion of ideological cartel, right? So you have the 1%. They own, but they don't manage. Then you have the 20%, the PMC, professional managerial class. And they are run by ideological cartels. And the 1%, they look at, like, who is best for us? So after World War II, you need a social compromise. We'll promote the Keynesians. You know, that was the A phase. That's got stuck in 73, 1980. End of the peak phase. Yeah, Keynesian is not working. We get inflation. No, no. So let's promote the Mount Pelerin Society, right? And now we have an identitarian cartel because divide and rule, and so we can continue to do our thing. That's the way I think of it.
Yep.
And it's very, very dangerous, of course, because if you're working class, you have nowhere to go. But to the right-wing populists, which have their own problems. And so I don't know how this is going to be worked out, but Toynbee has a very good example. So, you know, he talks about the Christians, the Jews, actually, in around the year zero, right? So you have the Zealots. The Zealots hate Rome, and they have three wars against Rome. They lose all three of them. And eventually that creates a diasporic necessity, right? And then you have King Herod. The Herodians are the compromisers. You know, let's work with empire. And maybe we can learn from them and then eventually become stronger and get our revenge later on. But he says the winner was neither of them, right? It was St. Paul, who had like a new mix, a new hybrid of both. And he succeeded with his church of blanketing the Roman Empire. So the solution, you know, is not in those two sides, right? Neither the Catholics nor the Reformation actually won the Civil War, because Hobbes and Smith won the Civil War, right? And they created a new system which marginalized the church. But now we're in this interregnum, right? We're in this, Gramsci calls it the time of monsters, right? The old is not dead yet and the new is not yet there. And so we get all that stuff, but there's no solution in there. That's not where the solution is. And I think the solution is in local communities, looking at your provisioning systems locally, but connecting and organizing constantly. And this, so now I'm going to make a pro crypto argument, because I shared your analysis, right? So what I was seeing was all the EOs, and they were always dealing with money, like, but they're out there, you know? How should we decide who spends what, who gets what? But I didn't see anything connected to production. And then I see all these urban commons alliances which exist, and they don't use crypto. But then I went to Montenegro, Zuzalu, Montenegro. And I was sitting on a table where they were discussing the environment. And there was a deep adaptationist, a doomer, right? Oh, we fucked. Nothing we can do about it. Then we had like a impact investment, you know, greenwashing type, yeah. Right? And then there was a climate denialist. And you know what? They had a friendly discussion. And I was shocked because I haven't seen that in years. You know, people that talk about this topic without wanting to kill each other, mm-hmm. virtually. And the reason is because they have a commons, right? They're all working on an infrastructure that they all can use together, even when they disagree about all these topics. And then I met a Chinese group, and they're my employers, conflict of interest. So I'm working for a network nation called the Global Chinese Commons, and they're Chinese crypto nomads. And, you know, it's almost illegal to do many things now in China. So they create a network of places where they can do their work and go back to their families, you know, when they're not doing crypto and stuff like that. And they were using, what's it called, quadratic voting to manage their physical assets. And I thought, wow, that is different. This is the first time I see this. And so, okay, I think this is the way to go. And they want to be at the service of local communities. They invest in public goods production, and they want to promote Chinese involvement in the global crypto community. So these for me are like, you know, proto everywhere, right? And I'm very proud to work with these people. I think they're, you know, they're great. And so I'm not saying everybody in crypto is like that, but there, you know, there are people. And I think the beauty of crypto is that these people can work together with other people. And, you know, like you have socialists and libertarians, and somehow they accept each other. And where else can you do this?
I would just, one thing I've been thinking about as you've been talking is this concept of what you brought up before, which was, you know, the creation of city states is sort of driven by one group. Maybe it's just overpopulation relative to resources, but one group taking up some violent culture, and then everybody else, has to adopt that because it's, right. You know, either defend yourself or, you know, I've heard this called the parable of the violent tribe, you know, basically right. once one becomes violent to defend yourself, you have to be violent or to run away, then yeah. They take over your area and then it's, you know, gets colonized. I just don't understand how in a digital crypto environment, that same theory can't also apply. I mean, you can have these peaceful, cooperative, digital groups. How do you, there's a chicken coming up. How do you?
You're Cosmoloco, I can see it.
Yeah, I know.
You can bring the chicken to the conversation.
Yeah, she'll run away from me. Chickens are just like one tiny bit faster than every human. You can never catch them. How does it not get colonized? This is my biggest concern with something like, you know, digital understandings, data, being able to control data. There's just this huge incentive to, you know, go the immoral route, you know, to take yes, advantage but... of it, to not make it open source, or once it is open source, yeah. to then, oh, so I have a huge profit motivation to take this and you know, close it off or to control people with it.
So you know, I don't think you can do this forever, right? But if so there again, this is very cyclic. But if you look at like the city states in Europe or Greece, they last around 300 years, and then they, you know, they got corrupted by, you know, the Medici, and but they did succeed for a certain time to protect a relatively strong egalitarian culture. And so, and the way they did is through anti-oligarchic protocols, right? So, you know, this is from reading. So, for example, in Italy, you know, the city would buy the grain, sell it at a fixed price, and only after 5 p.m. could the merchants, you know, operate on a market basis, right? So why this is normal. Like if you have hungry people in the city, you have a riot, right? You don't want a riot. Okay. And then they had hooded magistrates, always from other cities, so they were not emotionally connected to local people. And they had the right to execute merchants on the spot if they were caught, you know, speculating on food, right? Another example, the mayor of Dubrovnik, as soon as he was elected, he was put in a villa with guards. He was not allowed to get out of the villa for 2 years, and everybody came to visit him and to sign a register. So this was against, you know, lobbying, right? In Venice, they had like a 15-round voting system just to avoid manipulation of the votes. And, you know, in my Chinese community, they have explicit, you know, quadratic voting mechanisms. They're very strong on, you know, on not allowing money to overrun the community.
You want to describe quadratic voting real quick?
No, I can't. I haven't done enough reading to know exactly how it works. Mm. I did read one or two articles like a year and a half ago, but like, no, I can't really. What I understand is it promotes people who are regular contributors. So not the ones with a lot of tokens, but the ones who with little few tokens who intervene a lot. They get like a higher weight in the voting procedure.
One thing I would say is one thing I've been thinking about too as you're talking. It's possible also that there is like this, the thing I think about a lot is there is this sort of bifurcation going on where there's like, you know, the alienated, exploitative class, and maybe they all kind of associate with one another. And then there's this, you know, more cooperatively minded approach, and those people associate with each other, and they can just kind of like, you know, see which one does well. And the other thing I think about a lot is, something that's happening in advanced economies is that people are not reproducing, like you were saying.
Right.
In Thailand, are going into public school and not wanting to farm. A lot of those people don't even want to have kids. A lot of times, once they've gotten into the city and they get into advanced. I think there is like an inevitable evolutionary pressure happening also with too much alienation, too much, you know, advanced economic growth.
But you know, the end of Rome was exactly the same. So August, how do you say in English?
Augustus.
Augustus, right?
Yep.
He was already aware of the problem. So he had a law that even forced people to marry and have children. It didn't work. And so Italy got depopulated, Gaul, Spain, and then North Africa got depopulated. This is one of the main reasons Germanic invasions happened, because, you know, he couldn't mobilize enough people to be legionaries, right? So then he had to take in, not him, but his successor, had to take in the gods. And in the beginning, they were trained to be legionaries. And at the end, they just said, oh, yeah, just fight for us, right? And then the gods said, well, if we fight for them, why don't we just take it over, right? And that's how it ended, by that process. But the depopulation was the key. While in the East, that created Byzantium, there was still a population explosion. And so we are facing a depopulation bomb, right? Mm-hmm. That had started in Japan already 10 years ago. It's going to be, you know, and You know, I think probably migration is, you know, some, I think elite people are thinking we better get, you know, we better let in a sizable number of migrants, otherwise we will have no people.
Yeah.
Actually, no, Merkel said that. She said that openly at some point. So I think that, you know, the thinking is there. Because, you know, in I think in 1900, there were 400 million Europeans and 100 million Africans, right? And then in 20 years, it will be just the opposite. There'll be one European and four times as much Africans. And, you know, this creates a totally new geopolitics. Yeah. I have mixed feelings about this because, you know, I think there are too many people. So some amount of depopulation is probably not a bad thing, you know, because like 10 billion, that is just, that's a lot of stress on nature. But think about this, like one young person that has to work for four old people,
yep.
And then eight old people. Like, you know, we just have no idea how we're even going to do this.
Yeah, Jason, you had a good thread on this, actually, because it's a kind of a contentious topic, but, you know, especially for environmentalists. But if I paraphrasing, it's, you know, obviously there are a lot of people and there's a lot of environmental resource pressure with that many people. However, you know, making the population collapse so quickly that there's huge amounts of older people and not enough young people to sort of take care of them. Yeah. Will also cause a lot of environmental strain.
Well, one thing we talk a lot about on this podcast as well is energy availability and energy issues in general. And so, you know, from two different directions, you know, there's pushes to move away from fossil fuels, right? One is that they're non-renewable resources on you know, human timescales. And two is the greenhouse gas and climate issue and stresses on the larger environment. But the problem is that our civilization was built on coal and oil and now, you know, on natural gas. And we don't know how to run the civilization without that kind of fuel. It's not clear at all that we can maintain our lifestyles, you know, renewables, with
solar. But this is where mutualization comes in, right? So this is, you know, maybe against my better judgment, but this, you know, I would love, and so this is where, you know, the identitarianism is an absolutely terrible thing. Because
can I throw in one more thing before I let you go? Before I let you continue, and what I was getting to is that it seems likely to me that we're moving towards societies that will be have less energy availability, and by necessity will be also more labor intense, especially in agriculture. I think we're going to need a lot more people in agriculture again, and
industrious revolution.
Yeah, that requires youth. That requires strength. That, you know, in a demographic structure that's very top heavy, I don't see how that's viable, right? And so there you have this really difficult trade off between overpopulation, stressing the planet's resources, but then having a healthy demographic structure, right? And where you find that balance, and nobody really has control over it anyway, that's a wicked issue. That's a wicked problem.
Yeah. I've been looking at, you probably know him, Nafis Ahmed, who, you know, claims that it can be done. And I haven't studied enough to have my own judgment. So 100% renewable.
Yeah.
It can be done.
Yeah, we're skeptical of that on this podcast.
I'm skeptical, but I mean,
I think it's possible it can be done, but not at the same energy demand that today, and kind of energy use. I mean, liquid fuels is like 80% of the economy.
Right. Yeah. So here's the political issue that I wanted to address. So when I stopped working, you know, 15 years ago, I've always been political. So the idea was to have red-green coalitions, right? Because they're the most likely to push what I call common supportive policies. And, you know, it has happened at the local scale in Italy, in France. the problem is, you know, once they made this identitarian turn on the left, is that they're losing. Like the French left has lost 50% of its voting base, right? Yeah. And this is happening all over Europe. So then what we get is, and I think this is different on the continent than in the Anglo-Saxon countries. So we have these kind of populist alliances, right? But they have a very strong liberal point, you know, liberal in the sense of economically liberal point of view, right? So you have Trump, and he makes all these promises to the working class, and then he gets elected, and he makes a tax break for the billionaires, right? And actually lost working class votes in the last election. In Europe, the Hungarians and the Poles, they come from a Christian democratic background, right? They actually have basic income. If you're a family with two kids, and then with three kids, you get like 900 euros or 700 euros from the state. So they've been reelected four times. So they have managed markets from kind of Christian, right-wing Christian democratic point of view. And they're stable populist coalitions where the working class, according to survey, is the happiest on the continent. What I see in America, you know, I follow this very closely. I've lived in the U.S. and I worked like 9 years for United States Information Agency, if you believe me. So I'm very aware of American stuff. And, you know, I see the program of Vivek and Trump. You know, you're going to face a incredible counter-revolution. This is not going to be 2020. If they win, you're talking about dismantling the administrative state, abolishing the Department of Education, abolishing DEI and ESG, wanting 5% material growth, investing in fossil fuels. So, you know, we're going to get these swings, right? We're going to get these incredible swings. And I don't think they can solve the issue that way either, right? Because of the material situation. But this is going to happen. This is going to happen.
So the
only way is for some kind of progressive force, you know, to reconnect with, that's my view. You know, I'm an old style left, to reconnect with working class concerns. I like, in terms of macro change, I don't see any other solution, but I also can't see any signs that this is happening. So right. That's why I think for the moment, the only thing you can do is like, okay, you know, recreate local infrastructure, you know, make sure you can survive this wild period that is coming towards us, and like know where your food comes from, where your energy comes from, but connect trans locally, organize yourself, build power. Anyway, so that's kind of the way I look at things.
Well, this is, I think, a good, I mean, so we have to wrap up pretty soon. And I think this is a good topic, because this is a topic that what you just said, that we talk about a lot on this podcast. So, you know, a lot of things are out of our control. Politics is going to get weirder and weirder. And so what can we as individuals and groups of networked individuals do to prepare for the future, right? And it seems like you kind of answered that. Maybe we can elaborate a little bit more. You said, like, you know, relocalize, you know, ourselves and our communities, build up our local food systems, our local energy systems if we can, you know where our water comes. So all this localization, connect with others. Do you want to expand on that a little bit more, of like what we can do as just normal individuals and as networks to, you know, kind of keep working at building this counter power as
organized networks. I think this is very important, because
say something too before you answer. I think the other thing that I'd like to hear is the sort of temporal order for this. And I should just say, from my own perspective, I've seen a lot of attempts to sort of digitize first and build relationships through the digital fail pretty badly. Like the attempts to build build understandings or relationships or how things should be ordered or, you know, how things should be, like the governance. People try to digitalize first and then assume the relationships will follow. And I'm starting to think now, and I wonder whether you agree, that the physical, ecological, the relational, all of that should happen first, and then the digital should sort of bloom out of that. You know, where you're saying systems of provisioning.
It's a tool. It's a tool to make you stronger. And so, you know, one thing I noticed, this is just anecdotal, but like when I talk with a happy person on Zoom, they always tell me, oh, I quit social media. Like literally. Literally. Like it's, and unfortunately, I'm a digital curator. Like I'm stuck because, you know, I like learning. And, but actually, you know what I do? I start my day with 2 hours of reading. I don't open my computer in the morning. So I'm, you know, I'm trying to manage. But then I have, you know, 8 to 10 hours of online work. And it doesn't make me happy. You know, it doesn't make me happy. I feel I have to do it. So I think you're completely right. You know, we have to be embodied in our... So I'm a strange case, but I, you know, I'm actually embodied with my family, you know, my extended Thai family. And then, you know, I have a few local friends, not too many. And reading, you know, I know it sounds silly, but so we're going to a post-literate society, right? But reading is really essential for, kind of a self-construction. You know, the depth that you have through reading, right? The long run thinking. So I take notes. Then I reread my notes. So I read 90 minutes and then I think about what I've read for 30 minutes. And I've been doing this every day. First half an hour, then 1 hour. Now I'm at 2 hours total since 2020. But it's amazing. You know, this is very enriching, right? You really get to know stuff. Because I look back, even I was thinking in 2019, I say, what an ignorant guy I was. I think this is also, you know, if you don't have a past, you don't have a future. That's what I think. Right. And now it's like presentism, right? Everybody's stuck in the anxiety of the here and now, and that's just not healthy. And that's promoted by social media, the reactivity, right? So when you measure the brain activity, when you're on social media, it's your reptilian brain. It's not a neocortex, right? Mm-hmm. When you read, it's a neocortex. Mm-hmm. And so I think reading is essential. And maybe I'll end with this. I'm dreaming of a, you know, Renaissance technologist, the school for Renaissance technologists. And maybe you've heard about David Chapman, meaningless.com. Have you heard about it? Because this is, okay, I'll tell you his theory, and I agree with his theory. So, you know, in the 70s, we get postmodernism. You know, Derrida, Foucault, but these were all people who were classically trained, right? And then they critically reflect on modernity and objectivity. And I think that was a very useful exercise, you know, part of intellectual evolution. But then, you know, we stopped teaching all these things, right? So now what his problem is he says, we no longer have a bridge from the rational to the transrational. Because now you get young kids, they hardly learn anything in school. They go to the university, social science, and they get deconstructed. But there's nothing to deconstruct. And so now we have an explosion of confusion and mental illness. And so he says, if you look at STEM, you know, a bridge has to stand, right? So you have to be rational to build a bridge and a skyscraper and what an engineer would do, right? But they're too mechanistic, and so you can broaden their mind, you know, through holistic and more integrative thinking. And I think that's where we are. So I think that's, again, why I'm interested in crypto people, because they do have some kind of grounding, in several forms of rationality that tend to get lost. And I like the name of your program, Doomer Optimism. I'm sure you're aware of it, but so nowadays left-wing people have 300% more mental, diagnosed mental issues than right-wing people. And I think the reason is because they don't have hope. You know, they're so hypercritical. And you know, climate change and you know, so the whole, there's no transcendent horizon. And maybe the right wing, maybe because they're more linked to their family, to community, maybe to, you know, traditional religion, they still have a capacity to look on the other side. Although, you know, they tend to deny all the problems, right? That also maybe keeps you happy if you just don't want to see, you know, a lot of the issues that are on the horizon. But yeah, so that's basically what I try to do, is to have a narrative that is empirical, so willing to change if the facts change, that is coherent, and that creates the maximum amount of believable narrative for change, you know, based on what I know. So that's what I'm trying to do. I don't know if ultimately, you know, will be useful or not, but yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, to get that narrative of change, and you know, and constantly adapt it, and you know, and then I believe in deep conversations, right? Where, so this is, we used to do the twice a year with the P2P Foundation, and then we got defunded. But so we would bring groups together that didn't know each other, like, believe it or not, free software and free hardware didn't know each other 15 years ago, and you have them talk 4 or 5 days, you know, Indian stick, right? So you get the stick, you talk, then you finish, you give it to somebody else. So everybody can speak as long as they want, as short as they want. And so over several days, you create deep connections. And after 18 months after that meeting, miracles would happen. Because these people learned to trust each other, remained in touch, and somehow, you know, that soup that we created then created all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's so great. Yeah, it's pretty aligned with what we've been talking about, just within the podcast and the people that we've attracted. Just, you know, get them to make real relationships, real friendships, trusted relationships over time. And people are just itching for that invitation. And once you...
The good side of feudalism, by the way. You know, feudalism... Because, you know, I was listening to Yanis Varoufakis, his new book, right? He says there is a shift from profit to rent. And so these cloud capitalists, they're rent seekers. And so they have enslaved the capitalists. That's his thesis. I think he's right. Mm-hmm. But techno-feudalism, my only critique I have is actually feudalism was very personal. It was all based on personal loyalty. Yep. This is not feudalism. These people don't care at all who you are.
Yep. This goes back to my original comment, which is something to be aware of, the alienating nature of, you know, disembodiedness. And so I think keeping that in mind is really important.
It's very important what you're saying, that this is absolutely essential.
Yeah. And one day I just need to pick your brain about your historical understanding of different periods and movements over time, because it's so what a wide ranging knowledge you have. So I really appreciated this conversation. Thanks for organizing it, Jason.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you.
And I just want to say, you know, it's an honor to talk to you. We don't have protocols, but I definitely see Doomer Optimism. It's kind of modeled after the Cosmolocal idea, because we're using the internet to encourage people to localize and connect horizontally while they do that. So that's, I think we're very much aligned there. One last just little anecdote that I think I want to get to Ashley's last point, and I think this will also wrap it up, is that I was recently using a software that I was excited about. I'm still excited about, but it was the idea of like a software, like a bioregional organizing software. And I got a few people on, and most of the people didn't know each other. And eventually I had to shut it down because everybody, you know, not everybody, but a couple people in particular were fighting I kind of understood both their points of view. I figured if we were around a campfire, we could like work it out and, you know, develop some camaraderie if we did some projects together. But I ended up shutting it down because I decided that the scale was too large. We needed to meet more in real life. We needed to develop functional relationships where we collaborated on actual projects, getting our hands dirty. And I, you know, so it was premature. And eventually, you know, I see this software as being very valuable, but only after we set the groundwork of relationships.
And I agree with that. And that was the big mistake that we made. You know, think about Occupy and all that stuff. So an extraordinary ability to organize very rapidly millions of people.
Yeah.
But nothing lasted.
Yeah.
And it actually created the identitarian reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's often is a defeat of the progressives that leads to these kinds of outcomes because we fuck it up ourselves.
Well,
we can't redo that. We can't. This is done. We need to organize seriously over time, create trust, and allow people to have open conversation, have different opinions, and see commonality, right?
Well, hopefully, you know, I'm hoping as we all go forward in our projects, we can connect again in various ways, collaborate in various ways. And I mean, I feel like we could talk for hours more about these topics.
I can't, believe me.
I believe you. Cool. All right. Well, thanks both of you. This should be going up probably in a couple of weeks or so.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a really pleasure.
Oh, by the way, you want to talk about your Substack to wrap up?
But I'll probably send it to you. So there's two stuff to follow my work.
Mm-hmm.
The wiki, wiki.p2pfoundation.net, 25,000 articles, raked up 1 billion views over 15 years. Everything you ever wanted to know about peer-to-peer in the commons, in spirituality, in business, in politics. It's all there. It's really, really extensive. And then I just started because I just couldn't stand Facebook anymore. We've been creating for many years, but it's so sick and toxic. So I'm creating a Substack, fourthcivilization.substack.com. But, you know, maybe you can put it under the video and then people.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to write at least once a week, probably more. And I'm going to do my curation there. And because, you know, you keep your emails, I think they get 30%. Right now, I'm doing it for free. You know, eventually, maybe I'll have some articles for people who want to pay, but we'll see. I've been writing for free for 15 years. It's hard to change my habit.
Well, we appreciate it. It is a wealth of resources. I have looked through it myself. All right. Well, thanks to both of you. Until next time.
Have a good one, everybody.
Thank you.
Care.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.